Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Albert Morales, and this morning's conversation is with Dr. Ray Orbach, Undersecretary for Science and Director of the Office of Science at the U.S. Department of Energy. Also joining us in our conversation is Steve Sika, Federal Civilian Industry Leader at IBM. Ray, some have observed that given the complexity of future challenges, what is really needed are transformational discoveries and truly disruptive technologies. Would you define for us what is meant by transformational science, and to what extent is this type of science vital to our future?
We are looking at an energy crisis. We have learned that energy is limited, that its sources for us are unstable, and we need new sources of energy if we are going to survive as a nation, sources that are environmentally benign and abundant. When you say that, the first thing that comes to mind is what and how. And that's what we mean by disruptive technologies. We mean technologies that are not incremental, that don't simply add a little bit to what we already have, but are truly path-breaking. We have a phrase that's somewhat corny, but it's not altogether incorrect, and that is electricity was not invented by perfecting the candle. That's the situation that we're in now. If you look at lighting, for example, the lights in this room are about 5% efficient. We lose 95% of the energy for these lights due to heat that, frankly, we don't want. The best that you can do with fluorescence is about 20%. But all of these objects have the same vehicle, namely electrons or heat, providing the light that we use. What if we could generate light without heat? Think of the efficiency. It's a completely new direction, but in fact, it's a very possible direction. And those are what we call light-emitting diodes. It's a completely different technology than that which provides our incandescent bulbs or our fluorescent bulbs. And it has the capability of being 100% efficient because it's a direct conversion of electric current to light. That's a perfect example of what I have in mind, namely something that has no relationship to what's already present but has the potential of providing efficiency and benign environmental effects and therefore adding to our energy capability. There are many other areas that one can point to. I can think immediately of biofuels, where today's conventional approach is through corn, where we take the sugars and starch and convert them by fermentation to ethanol. But what about the rest of the plant? What about the plant fibers and the cellulose that gives the plant its nutritional pathways? We don't make any use of that, and we call that cellulosic ethanol. That is the ability to produce fuel from the stalk of the plant, from the parts that we now throw away or use as fertilizers. How do we do it? We don't know how to get past the cell walls, the so-called lignins, to get at the materials inside that we would like to break down into the sugars that we could then create fuel from. That's transformational. The current ways we have are either through heat or for chemicals that, first of all, waste energy and also are not environmentally very friendly. But I ask you to consider the termite. The termite, if you've ever had any, is a remarkable machine. It can take apart a piece of wood so fast that it's frightening. How does it do it? It doesn't use harsh chemicals, and it doesn't use excess heat. It uses bacteria inside its hind gut that breaks down the cell walls and enables it to digest the cellulose that's inside the plant material. We have to figure out how nature does it. So these are the kinds of changes that we're talking about, taking a different path, a different road that has tremendous potential, also is risky. We may not be successful, but without it, we'll never get beyond the current limits that face us in the energy world.
That's certainly fascinating. Now, last year, the president announced a commitment to double the budget for basic research in the physical sciences at key agencies over the next 10 years to maintain U.S. leadership in science. Could you tell us more about the American Competitiveness Initiative, the ACI, and the role the Office of Science has in making it a success?
It was a fabulous statement by our president It was the first time I had heard any president talk about the physical sciences in those specific terms. And as he laid out what he hoped to achieve with the ACI, I saw the Office of Science as a key element in that enterprise. And to be a part of the administration and be able to carry out that agenda during my tenure as director of the Office of Science was so exciting that it led to our commitment to provide the president with the results that he so generously was funding.
Given the breadth and depth of the Office of Science's research portfolio, would you elaborate on your organizational restructuring project that's also known as the 1SC initiative? How did this initiative reduce layers of management and streamline decision-making as well as making more efficient use of resources?
When I looked at the Office of Science when I first took over the directorship, I saw a hierarchical structure that, first of all, had many layers, but even worse, separated my office from our laboratories and the administration of our research grants at universities. I didn't want that separation. I didn't want what we called operation offices in between me and the researchers. And so we flattened our organization. And the 1SC was our name for what has now become, in fact, an operational entity. Right now, we have 10 national laboratories that report directly to the Office of Science Director. You know many of them. They are the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory, Argonne National Laboratory, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, Brookhaven National Laboratory, and so on. We have a presence at each of these laboratories through what we call our site offices. And those site office managers report directly to me. There's no intermediary, whereas before they went through a hierarchical structure before it ever got to my office. As a consequence, we have very direct reporting and also a much more rapid response time. As things happen, we can provide resources and provide assistance on a very rapid scale, whereas before we had to go through a series of intervening steps, some of which meant that the material never reached my desk. So it's a responsive and efficient structure that I believe fulfills the president's management agenda.
It's often said that science is based on two pillars, namely experiment and theory. Can you explain to our listeners to what extent high-end computation, especially through simulation, has become a true third pillar of scientific discovery? And can you also elaborate on how DOE's Advanced Scientific Computing Research, the ASCR program, is at the forefront of these advances?
It's a complementary contribution. The idea is the following. One can produce theories about physical phenomena. Ultimately, they have to be verified by experiment. But what if the phenomena are so complex that there is no simple theory that's predictive? What do you do then? Well, one thing you can do is a set of experiments, but then you have no way of describing what those experiments measured. What we are finding through high-end computation is that we have enough power now, and by the way, this is a relatively recent event, to be able to simulate nature itself. That is, to take the various parts that nature has and make them do what nature does, but do it computationally so that we can literally twist the knobs and explore different phenomena and different regions of behavior. And from that, we can then predict, just as a theory would, the behavior of physical systems. So you can think of computation and especially simulation as completely equivalent to the theoretical discoveries which closed-form equations can provide, but in situations that are much too complex for us to be able to describe. There's also a whole world out there for which there are no equations. We have random systems, systems that have no order and which make theoretical predictions difficult, if not impossible. Through simulation, we can derive their properties, and they are very surprising. Nature has some real surprises for us. And so that combination of simulation and experiment to test the simulation are proving a triad of avenues towards discovery. I should say one thing more. It's not just scientific discovery. It's also economic enhancement. We are finding more and more now that industry is beginning to use simulations to reduce time to market, to reduce development costs, as these machines become sufficiently powerful to meet their needs. So you're seeing high-end computation both on the research side, but also on the very practical, on a purely economic side that industry faces.
Let me turn to another important initiative. What is the Scientific Discovery Through Advanced Computing Program, the SCIDAC, and more importantly, how does it coordinate investments across all of the Office of Science mission areas?
We call SCIDAC a interdisciplinary approach. It's one thing to have a computer. It's another thing to make it work. And what SCIDAC does is to bring together the scientist who wants to calculate something or simulate a particular phenomena and the people who know how the machine works, the computer scientists, the applied mathematicians, the people who develop algorithms. They form teams, and as teams, they can make the most effective use of the computational capabilities that we provide. Most scientists are much too impatient to actually explore machine dynamics and exactly how the computer works and how to optimize it. But that's what computer scientists and applied mathematicians do for a living. By bringing them together, we can make more efficient the codes that the scientists develop, sometimes by factors of 10, sometimes 100 times faster. Now, that means that problems that normally would be immense and no computer could solve suddenly become feasible on the computers that we have currently at hand. So SCIDAC has proven to be a remarkable accomplishment of the Office of Science. It also separates the United States from its foreign competitors. Very few countries have managed to bridge that interdisciplinary gap. It gives the United States leadership over any other country in the world in terms of use of high-end computation.
Ray, earlier you talked to us a little bit about the research facilities that you manage. Could you elaborate on a plan called the Facilities for the Future of Science, a 20-year outlook? How does it answer the salient question of what facilities are needed for the next scientific discovery? And can you give us a sense of how you prioritize your efforts?
That has turned out to be a wonderful example of the interaction between the Office of Science and the scientific world, and the wonderful advantage that the director of the Office of Science has when it comes to setting science priorities. When I first started as director of the Office of Science, I was told by Congress and by the administration, "You scientists want everything. All you want is this new machine or this new toy, as it sometimes is referred to, and you don't care about the cost. Why can't you prioritize?" Well, of course, scientists have prioritized, but we have never prioritized across fields. We prioritized within high-energy physics as what kind of facilities we need. We've also prioritized within condensed matter physics. But no one had ever prioritized between high-energy physics and condensed matter physics, or for that matter, biology or other fields of science. How in the world do you compare different branches of science when it comes to a budgetary prioritization? That was a challenge that was given to us in the early 2002 period by Congress and by the administration. What we did was to define prioritization on the basis of scientific impact. That is, we charged our advisory committees to lay out their priorities for their particular field of science and give us a description of the science advantages that would then obtain if those facilities were to be built. We also asked them to give us an idea of when those facilities could be built. Some of them, for example, you didn't know what the technologies were, and so they were really in the future. And over time then, we had from each of the scientific communities a vision of their priorities for their field and the consequences of investment. Then it was relatively straightforward to take, on the basis of the consequences of the science investment, a comparison between fields. We also had some budgetary stringency that we forced upon ourselves so that we weren't just asking for everything. We took the authorization levels that Congress had indicated would be in the future for the Office of Science, and we took a look 20 years out using more or less the index of inflation to give us an idea of what our budget would look like. We then fit underneath that envelope the basic costs associated with research and with the administration and so on. And what was left was for facilities. That reduced the number of facilities, which initially were over 50, down to 28, and also gave us a time scale for when we should invest in what facility. And that was issued in November of 2003. It has been remarkably robust. It has given us an approach to investment in terms of large-scale facilities, and we have just finished an update on where we're at now in 2007. We expect that it will show that the Office of Science has been vigilant in its commitment to quality and budget at the same time. We have worked within budget. We've built our facilities according to budget and according to timescales that were predicted in the past. We've really used that prioritization for our operations. I hope that this will give the administration and Congress a sense of confidence in the Office of Science, that we're worth the money that they invest in us, and that we can show that we can use it wisely and effectively.
What about the Department of Energy's bioenergy research efforts? We will ask Dr. Raymond Orbach, Undersecretary for Science and Director of the Office of Science at the U.S. Department of Energy, to share with us when the conversation about management continues on the Business of Government Hour.